From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sexual assault is not a new problem in the United States military, but the numbers and headlines rolling out in recent weeks have people from the front lines to the Pentagon to the White House talking about a military sexual assault levels now in terms of a crisis. Congress is all over it with some legislation that would move military sex crimes prosecution outside the reach of the chain of command. In military terms, that is a big deal. Is it time? This hour on Point, solving the U.S. military sex abuse problem and the chain of command. We will hear in this hour the view that the chain of command must be interrupted to solve this and the view that that would be a big mistake. For the latest on what's being proposed in Washington, we go first to David Martin, national security correspondent for CBS News. David Martin, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The numbers of this latest survey that had 20-plus thousand reporting some kind of sexual abuse and the headlines about men who were in charge of preventing sexual abuse themselves becoming abusers have got everybody, it seems, up in arms in Washington. What's the range of proposals being rolled out to confront this, David?
Well, they range from sticking with the current system and just trying harder to taking away prosecution of sex crimes, taking it away from the traditional military chain of command and putting it in the hands still of the military, but of military prosecutors, so that, for instance, a woman sailor on a ship who wanted to report a sexual assault would not have to go tell the captain of the ship. She would simply go tell a prosecutor about it, and that would take it out of the chain of command.
Can you explain for us, David, how the chain of command works here? Because we've seen these cases where there were sexual abuse charges, there were prosecutions and even convictions, and then a commanding officer comes in and just takes the alleged and I guess convicted perpetrator and says no, they're not going to suffer consequences here. We're ending this, and it doesn't happen. How does that work?
Well, it's a function of the extraordinary power that commanders are given in the military system. I mean, after all, they have the power of life and death over the people that serve under them, and so part of that was this ability to review the results of a court-martial, the overturning of these cases. There have been, in fact, two cases that have gotten a lot of attention. The overturning is rare, but it happened that one of those cases is brought a lot of attention onto this. You'd almost call it a quirk in the military system, which I think most people outside cannot understand. I mean, people can understand, okay, you're convicted, then you appeal through the normal appeal process. But I think it's hard for most people to understand, okay, you're convicted, and then one person, a three-star general, gets to say, no, I wasn't convinced by the evidence. I reverse this conviction.
What about the numbers here? People are talking about a crisis. I mean, all the way up to the Pentagon and the Oval Office, this is the new language here. And there are two sets of numbers that I've seen, some about actual reported cases of abuse or assault, and others, a kind of a survey done of lots of military members that came up with this number of 26,000 instances last year. What kind of numbers are we looking at, David?
Well, you're looking at hard numbers in the case of the reports of sexual assault. And for 2012, I think the exact number was 3,374. But everybody recognizes that sexual assault is a vastly underreported crime, and so that larger number, 26,300, is the estimate based on the prevalence of all these unreported cases. However, the larger number is unwanted sexual contact, which is more inclusive than pure sexual assault.
So that would be everything from rape to what, groping or uncomfortable?
Yeah, they call it abusive sexual contact. So I don't think we're talking about an unwanted hand on the shoulder here. I think we're talking about somebody forcing himself on another person.
The Pentagon, Chuck Hagel, defense secretary, says we want to handle this internally. We will do it. Is there reason to think that there could be something done now that they could do that they haven't already tried?
Well, in the end, it's got to be handled by the chain of command. I mean, the chain of command is responsible for everything else. They're responsible for discipline in the ranks. That includes AWOLs. It includes drunk driving. And it includes sexual assault. So even if you have this off-the-chart system for prosecuting cases where you take it out of the chain of command, the problem of sexual assault in the military is only going to be solved by the chain of command. And my own opinion is that what it's going to take is when commanders come to realize that their careers depend upon this. I mean, right now, a commander is judged on the performance of his unit in combat, in training, and if his unit does well, then he advances in his career. Commanders, unless there is an egregious case in their unit, usually don't get judged on the atmosphere about surrounding sexual assault in their units. And they are now going to start taking these command climate surveys, finding out from people in the units what the what they think of the climate in that unit, and they're going to start giving those surveys to the officer in charge of that unit's superior officers. So that's the kind of thing that I think has to happen before you're going to get real change.
You've had a lot of people just really fired up on Capitol Hill about this after all these latest reports, and in particular, female U.S. senators in the Senate, and above all, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand out of New York, the Democrat there, has made this a big issue, and she is going after the chain of command and saying we need prosecutors to move front and center here. I'm sure you heard this, but here's a little tape, David Martin, of her on Thursday talking about the need for change on sexual assault in the military. She's put legislation forward to reform the military justice system and remove sexual assault cases from the chain of command. Here's Senator Gillibrand.
So today we're standing in united front to take on these issues with new legislation that will fundamentally remove the decision-making from the chain of command and gives that discretion to an experienced military prosecutor where it belongs. Just like many of our allies have already done around the world, Britain, Canada, Israel, Germany, Norway, and Australia, just to name a few.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York saying, look, all these other countries have done it. They've taken these kind of cases outside the chain of command. It's time to do it here. What do you see in terms of the likely progress of that legislation, David, and how is the Pentagon responding to this push?
Well, women are much more powerful on the Hill than they were the last time sexual assault in the military became a big issue. And so I think that increases the chances that these bills are going to make their way toward passage. And on this specific issue of taking the sexual assault cases out of the chain of command and handing them over to military prosecutors, the Pentagon does not look like it's going to fight that. I mean, you can't be sure until they take an official position. But they all seem to have an open mind about that, and are not just steadfast against no, the commander's got to be responsible for everything.
David Martin, national security correspondent with CBS News, joining us today from Washington. David, thank you very much for your insights.
Sure thing.
I want to turn to Elizabeth Beth Hillman, joining us from San Francisco, professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, former professor of history at the U.S. Air Force Academy. Elizabeth Hillman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Do we ultimately have to go to the chain of command around sexual abuse and assault cases to solve this? Do we have to interrupt it?
I think there's no question, as David pointed out, that the chain of command will be crucial to the ultimate solutions in this arena of a really difficult and hard to overcome social and criminal and legal problem. But removing the commanding officer as the prosecutorial authority in the military justice system seems a simple fix, that there's little reason to protest, as you pointed out.
But command authority has been there for a long, long time. You heard the senator rattle off the other countries that have already done it. The United States has not done it. Do you think the Pentagon, the military establishment, is ready to do it now?
Well, we suffer from some exceptionalism here in the United States and in our military in particular. We have a different force structure. We have different responsibilities and different challenges. But we also share a lot of the same problems that other militaries do. And I think our armed forces are ready for a change in this regard. There's also some generational disconnects within the armed forces. The judge advocates who are now training commanding officers and service members generally about our understanding of sexual assault that's based on empirical data about who commits sexual assault, about what prevention strategies work, they're facing some challenges with convincing more senior officers to understand and sort of integrate that new information into their assessment of what constitutes a person likely to commit these kinds of crimes. So I think this would be a relief in many respects for commanding officers and for their legal advisors, the judge advocates.
Elizabeth Hillman, please stand by in San Francisco, former U.S. Air Force captain, with us here, now professor of law, looking at this issue of how to solve the military's sex abuse problem and whether to break the chain of command when it comes to sexual assault. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about how to solve the military's sex abuse and assault problem and whether it's time to break the chain of command when it comes to sexual assault. It is not as though it is a new issue. It's been around for a long time. Here's a series of little clips of folks. This is from the Air Force Academy Superintendent, the Chief of Naval Operations, Robert Gates, Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, all of them saying, going back to 1991, they won't put up with sexual abuse and assault in the U.S. military.
We have zero tolerance for it.
We're not going to put up with sexual harassment.
I have zero tolerance.
We have absolutely no tolerance for any form of sexual assault.
Okay, but those go back to 1991, and we are still in the thick of this. The worst numbers we've ever seen. Just last week at a press conference in Washington, former technical sergeant in the Air Force Jennifer Norris said she was raped, sexually assaulted, retaliated against. Fighting back tears, she said she had difficulty seeking justice within the military chain of command.
I became one of far too many who fall victim to manipulation and abuse of authority by perpetrators who are higher ranking and have more credibility with those who are in charge. Troops have no choice but to acquiesce when under the leadership of a heavy-fisted chain of command.
And this for volunteers for the U.S. military. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York saying this can't go on. I mean, the headlines about people in charge of stopping this themselves engaged in it, and then the chain of command requiring that even their authority be respected. Here's the senator.
When a person in charge of preventing sexual assault in their ranks is himself arrested on charges of alleged sexual assault, clearly we have a strategy in place that is not working. Twice in just 1 week, this has happened. And when any single victim of sexual assault is forced to salute her attacker, clearly our system is broken.
Everybody wants this fixed. How do we do it? Elizabeth Beth Hillman is with us, former U.S. Air Force captain, now professor of law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law, formerly at the U.S. Air Force Academy, joins us from San Francisco. Also with us today from Washington, John Altenberg, retired Major General in the U.S. Army, where he served as a Green Beret and officer in the Judge Advocate General's Corps, served 28 years as a lawyer in the Army. Very, very high-level service there, with all kinds of responsibility around the world. John Altenberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
People are just really upset about these numbers and about this experience that too many of our military are going through, and the focus has turned to the chain of command as potentially part of the problem. You heard Senator Gillibrand say last week, look, a lot of our allies have already removed this kind of problem from the chain of command. Britain, Canada, Israel, Norway, Australia. Is it time, John Altenberg, for the chain of command to be broken, disrupted, interrupted when it comes to sexual abuse and assault?
Well, it may be. The chain of command certainly hasn't solved it to date. I personally believe, and Beth and David said the same thing, that the chain of command has got to be a part of the solution. The issue is, do they need to be a part of the prosecutorial discretion piece of it? But they clearly have to be a part of the solution. And other problems we've had in the past, it took the chain of command active engagement to solve those issues. And I think about the 70s and the race relations issues that we had in the military then. And in the 80s, we had a huge crisis of child abuse by service members, the same with DUIs. And in each of those situations, it took getting the chain of command engaged and educated and trained to understand all the permutations of those issues and the complexities before we finally solved it. But it took the chain of command to solve those issues. And even more recently, the issue of resiliency because of all the deployments took engagement by the chain of command to understand the nuances of what was happening to our people based on repeated deployments. And most recently, the transition to gays serving openly in the military it happened because the chain of command, they took the time to train them and educate and get them involved and made it their responsibility to make this happen smoothly.
So you're saying there's a historical track record of the chain of command working for progress, working in a good way here. But on this front, the numbers look worse than ever. Can you explain why would it be that even with great respect for the chain of command, a commanding officer would be given the authority to overturn a court-martial decision when it comes to sexual abuse, assault? Why would that be a power given to a commander?
That's an historic, authority. It goes back 200 years, was reinforced after World War II by General Collins and General Eisenhower in their testimony before the House and Senate panels. And it's supposed to be just that, an extraordinary exercise of power, hardly ever used. And it's to say the least, unfortunate that this case in Italy occurred. It's unfortunate that it occurred, period. It's even more unfortunate that it occurred when it occurred.
This is the case of Kimberly Hanks.
That's right.
She won assault case against Air Force Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson, former Inspector General. This is at the Aviano Air Base in Italy. And that conviction was overturned by a top Air Force commander, Lieutenant General Craig Franklin. Kimberly Hanks was socializing with some co-workers at Wilkerson's home. Here's some sound from ABC News. She talked about how she ended up sleeping in a guest bedroom there. Here she was talking with Michael Isikoff just last Monday about the attack that ensued.
I had felt some discomfort. The lights came on, which woke me up. And I opened my eyes, and he was in bed with me with his hands down my pants.
This is the Inspector General at the airbase there in Italy. A jury's conviction overturned by top Air Force Commander Lieutenant General Craig Franklin. And then we had the accused and convicted sent out to Tucson where her family lived. They held a protest outside the base there. This is her brother, Kim Hanks' brother, Stephen, speaking at the protest about what had gone down, what happened, saying he was appalled.
We're here today because the military justice system, which was the only justice system available to her in Europe, failed her and failed her miserably.
Beth Hillman, I want to come to you on this. We have lots of callers who want to come right in here. Tom in Shelbyville, Tennessee. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, I think we're sending our sons and daughters, our nephews, our nieces, our cousins, our friends off to protect the country. And the military is having such a poor time in protecting them while under their control. And I think that we should have had a lot more of these top heads' role than what we've had, and we wouldn't even have this problem. And we're getting lip service from the top, but no action down on the ground where it could actually make a difference. And I want to know why there haven't been more military personnel totally sacked and brought down ranks whenever they have to retire, so that, you know, there's a clear message that we're not going to put up with it, and it's not just words.
You and a whole lot of other people, Tom, will look at exactly that. Let me get one more call right here. Thank you, Tom. Camille in Franklin, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Camille.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a high school teacher, and I have a difficult time supporting my young girl's decision to enlist in the military because I feel like, especially enlisted, have more people above them who can abuse them. And I was a lieutenant 20 years ago at a military hospital, and we young female lieutenants were basically told not to report a high-level doctor there because he got so much money for grants from the Congress people he knew.
So the chain of command was not working for you because a superior officer was the problem?
Yes, yes.
Camille, thank you for your call. Beth Hillman, do you have a particular proposal here? Do you go along with Kirsten Senator Gillibrand's idea? What would you propose here?
I think the solution has many parts, and I think that Senator Gillibrand's proposal has both a lot of merit and some legs that could make a difference. I also think the Department of Defense has welcomed the possibility of more change now, including Secretary Hagel, who suggested to Congress that power you just talked to General Altenberg about, and I'm happy to be here with John Altenberg, for whom I have great respect, for his service and his perspective on this. You know, that proposal to end the role of commanding officers in eliminating the findings that happen after a court-martial, to be able to wipe out, not only to change a sentence, but actually eliminate a conviction, the Secretary of Defense.
It's not even on the record, you mean.
That.
It's just gone.
That's right. It's gone. But the Secretary of Defense has asked Congress to intervene on that. So part of what we have here is not the best of relationships between congressional development of statutes and congressional action and the military's involvement and interaction in that process, because they do want some changes, too. You know, your first caller asked about why haven't more of the top brass been punished? This is a tough question. Commanding officers try to do the right thing in really virtually all instances. And when they're I have great faith that they're trying to do the right thing. But neither do I think they've been successful in that regard, which a frustration that's reflected in that caller's statement. Commanding officers have to protect the rights of the service members in the criminal justice system when they're being prosecuted, too. And that creates a real challenge in getting some of these criminal convictions and in the investigation process.
Well,
the question about this. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, just that you're saying they're trying to do the right thing, but it's for civilian and maybe for military, too. It's hard to understand when a court martial has come to a finding, to a decision here. How could the right thing be overturning that or just eliminating the finding outright if the case has been carefully heard and here comes the result, here comes the finding, and it's just tossed? It's hard to understand that.
Agreed. And I think that needs to change. I think it's an archaic remnant of an old military justice system that did not have the protections in the trial process that it now has. It really mimics civilian criminal justice in virtually all respects, but for a few significant differences. And I don't think that authority should be there. I think that the general in this case likely did that because of misplaced loyalty to that particular officer who had otherwise performed well in duties that were assigned.
Boy, it's hard to figure. We have a caller or listener here. Miriam writes to us on Facebook. She says, the good old boy system is too pervasive. John, what do you make of that criticism here?
That's an accurate criticism. I agree 100% with the observation that the good old boy system is in force. And that's partly an explanation, not an explanation, but it describes what happened in Italy. That extraordinary power, in my opinion, was never meant to be exercised in a case like that. It was probably meant to be exercised in a combat theater when we're at war under really extraordinary circumstances. The other thing is, and I want to explain what I mean by the good old boy system, it is a male culture. It has been for 200 years. It didn't really start to change much until the late 70s and early 80s when more and more women started coming into the service. And we haven't figured that out yet, and that's why what's been suggested and made a part of law in the last 6 or 7 years, and especially in the last year or two, is finally helping to get to where the chain of command can turn this around. Huge changes just in the last 2 years that will, in my opinion, lead to the chain of command understanding the nature of this crime, understanding how much a part of our culture it is, the male culture, and this is okay, and that's all right, and this is acceptable, understanding what it's like for the victims. And I think we've just been insensitive to that as an institution. And those changes have to come. And again, I come back to, I think that the chain of command is the engine for that, and it's getting to them first, and then having the chain of command, you know, make it happen in the system the same way they've done in all these other examples that we talked about.
But let me ask you then, to make that change in the culture, would you be prepared? Do you think it's wise to break the chain of command when it comes to this power to overturn court-martial findings, eliminate findings? Would you support that?
I support looking at that. I support being open to that, as I think some people in the Pentagon have said. My concern, my greatest concern, perhaps my only concern right now moving forward, is that we don't do it precipitously and too quickly without considering the unintended consequences. We passed a law in 2006 to change the statute in the Uniform Code of Military Justice relating to sexual assault. And within a few years, it was held unconstitutionally applied in most courts, and we had to completely redo that statute in 2012. And I would just say that that problem in 2006 was created, it was the product of moving too quickly and not considering everything. And much of it wasn't, you could tell it wasn't intended by the Congress, mm-hmm. but we didn't spend enough time looking at it. And so I think that these committees and these groups and the senators and the congresswomen, we need to look and see, you know, what's going to happen when we make this change. If we take it away from the commanders who have the responsibility for combat effectiveness and combat readiness of our nation's forces, and we push it onto the lawyers, will the lawyers become more concerned with their batting average, so to speak, with their win-loss record, or will they be as willing to do the right thing, regardless of whether it's a difficult case? And the best prosecutors in the country, military and civilian, they will always do that. But there are others who are in the civilian sector more concerned about re-election, and in both sectors more concerned about, gee, I don't want to lose this case. And so that's a different piece that would be injected into it if we took it to the lawyers.
Beth
and I come back again to the commanders being ultimately responsible for the combat readiness of the force, and that includes all of these matters.
Beth Hillman, do you see some erosion of that responsibility for combat readiness if we remove this one piece? And I understand it can be pervasive. It can get into the culture, get into issues of authority. But if we remove that, does it undercut responsibility for combat readiness, Beth?
I don't think so. But I agree that it has to be undertaken with a careful attention to the consequences. The thing is, I think we're undermining the effectiveness of our commanders in the field if we can't staff the military with the people it needs in order to be successful. And right now, questions like your second caller there who asked about how she can advise students who are interested in a military career.
Her daughters.
Young women. Mm-hmm. Yes, young women. Students and our daughters to go into the armed forces, which I did too. I had a hard time with that. A few weeks ago, I was at Villanova University for a showing of The Invisible War, a documentary about military sexual assault that has helped to galvanize mm-hmm. much of this reaction. Mm-hmm. And the entire Naval ROTC unit was there at the order of their commanding officer. And one of those midshipmen stood up and asked, "What should I tell my sister who's in high school that will overcome her fears about joining the military?" And I thought, I don't know what you should tell her, because it's not clear to me that we have the systems in place that enable her to feel confident that, first, a sexual assault won't occur, and second, if it does, that it will be handled appropriately. And it's that lack of confidence, which is one of the goals of the military's sexual assault prevention and response team and office and entire program right now. Restoring confidence requires some fundamental changes right now.
Had a lot of attention after recent surveys have come out showing big numbers and big growth in the incidents, which was already too big. And then people who are in charge of pushing back against this themselves facing charges of sexual abuse, sexual assault. Last Thursday, the president called the defense secretary over to the White House and came out and said it's shameful, disgraceful. Here's President Obama.
Not only is it a crime, not only is it shameful and disgraceful, but it also is going to make and has made our military less effective than it can be. And as such, it is dangerous to our national security.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, alongside the president, saying we, that is the military, will fix this.
We've in many ways failed, but we all have committed to turn this around, and we're going to fix the problem. As the president said in his comments after that meeting, there's no silver bullet. This is going to take all of us. The problem will be solved here in this institution, and we will fix it, and we will do everything that we need to do to fix it.
The problem will be solved here in this institution. Beth Hillman, can you explain to us the interaction of Pentagon and Congress here? There's a lot of activity on Capitol Hill now to move legislation that would change the way things are done. Senator Gillibrand's legislation would give military prosecutors rather than commanders the power to decide which sexual assault cases to try. Where does this ultimately get fixed? And are you confident that the Pentagon will do what's necessary to make this right, Beth?
I'm confident the Pentagon will do a lot. I'm not confident the Pentagon can do everything that's needed to be done to resolve this problem. And notwithstanding Secretary Hagel's statement that it's the Department of Defense that needs to fix this, mm-hmm. I think we all have to fix this on many different fronts. For instance, the potential of civil liability, of damages for military victims of sexual assault. I think that could make a difference, both for the confidence of service members who might report and for the incentives to make this change. Throughout military culture and not only in the military legal system. One change that could help, I think, right now is last week each of the service chiefs sent to the Secretary of Defense their plan for the integration of women into combat positions within the armed forces in response to the decision by the White House that, that this is going to be a change in the policy that has restricted women from combat-related occupational specialties in the armed forces. That change, like the change in the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the end of the ban on open service by gays and lesbians, that's a sign of change in the demographics, the culture of the armed forces that will help to change the culture of sexuality and of sexual interaction and behavior and of the gender dynamics that John Altenberg referred to that has helped to make this problem persist.
General Altenberg, here was Senator Gillibrand again last Thursday talking about her proposed legislation, explaining exactly what she hoped the reform would do. Let's listen for a second. I want to get your response. Senator Gillibrand of New York.
Under our bill, serious crimes punishable by more than a year of confinement would be investigated and prosecuted by the JAG Corps, experts specifically trained on this issue who know how to carry out the investigation and take cases to trial. We make a sensible exemption for crimes that are uniquely of the military in nature, such as disobeying orders or going absent without leave. When we take these cases outside of the chain of command, we give the victims the basic confidence to know that justice will be had and that there will be accountability and transparency in their case.
General Altenberg, can you get the chain of command behind the changes that need to be made culturally and at the same time take authority away from them when it comes to deciding what cases should be tried in instances of sexual assault?
As I said, I'm open to that being a possibility, but the comments that we just heard reflect a lack of information concerning how the system works. Huge change since 68 and 70 in how military justice is administered in the military, and it wasn't in an even way in all the services, but now all the services have caught up with each other, and lawyers are completely engaged in this process. There are not commanders making decisions about what cases to prosecute and what cases not to prosecute without the advice of a senior lawyer. They do it together, and in that sense, staff judge advocates, senior lawyers, and commanders who are convening authorities are informing and educating each other about values and what's important. And a commander who perhaps is reluctant to send a case to trial because he thinks it's a good soldier and he doesn't think much of the victim and her credibility or his credibility, you know, will have that offset by an SJA who understands the importance of prosecuting the case in spite of those kinds of issues.
But the authority still ends up in the hands of the commander, right? I mean, the difference here is between advice and authority, and they're talking about where that power ultimately resides to finally make the decision.
And personally, I think right now that belongs there. Now, it belongs with the commander because the commander is responsible for the combat readiness of his organization. And so he needs all the tools. He doesn't need just to be able to do the training and do the education. He needs to be able to be the ultimate disciplinarian or at least to decide whether it goes to trial.
Let's go to Michelle in Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Michelle. I'm a veteran 20 years. I was in the Women's Army Corps first, and then I went into the regular Army. This is systemic. I've seen the invisible war. I've actually been a part of the interviews. Raped twice, one by my ex-battalion XO. He wasn't going anywhere. The second one was by one of my peers, and he didn't go anywhere either. However, I have a friend named Marnita Magruder, and she was actually put out at 18 years of service. The reason she was put out is because she would not give in to a master sergeant's, a command sergeant major's come on. And so he made it so that she was crazy. Then she was overweight. 10 years later, she fought it, and she got everything back. But it took 10 years and all of her severance money.
What's the solution, Michelle, inside the military so that doesn't have to happen? What's the solution?
The solution is that the commander should not tip the jury. Once the commander says, okay, the case is going to be heard, then that's it. He gets in it no more. He rarely knows the person, the victim, male or female, but he does know the jury, and he does. And even if you send it to another reservation, he knows that general there. They know each other. It's the way it is.
The old boy network we heard about earlier, Michelle. We've got, and I appreciate your recounting. Beth, how would you draw the lines of authority here, very specifically around the progress of these cases?
Well, Michelle's story raises a common critique of military justice, and that involves the fact that the convening authority who sends the charges forward to a court-martial also selects the pool of persons from which the court-martial panel, equivalent to a civilian jury, is pulled. And that's in the statute. Congress has to change that in the Uniform Code of Military Justice because it instructs the convening authority to do that, to choose the persons most qualified to make those decisions on the grounds that you don't want a random selection of people on a court-martial panel. You actually want the people who are best equipped by virtue of service and experience and temperament to make decisions in this this grave forum of criminal justice.
Does that work in the military, or is it a problem? Beth?
Well, I think it largely works. I think that it's a structural problem. I'm a law professor. I believe in the value of process. I think due process matters in the military. I think it creates a conflict in the system. I think that a random selection of panel members, which the Army has experimented with, which is certainly a possibility, but one reason we haven't done it is operational considerations. It's tough to decide who has the time. Who has the time to be on a civilian jury when you get that card in the mail?
Right.
And who has the time in the military to serve on a military court-martial panel? And convening authorities, commanding officers have sought to retain that control to make sure they meet their mission considerations. But Michelle's proposal would be simply to, you know, get the to allow the convening authority to still prefer charges, but to remove them from the panel selection process, which has long been a recommended reform, and get them out of the post findings phase of the court martial as well. All of which would help the procedural regularity of the system.
John Altenberg, would you support that, taking away that power to pick the jury from the commander?
I would not. I mean, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. We're critical of the 3-star in Italy because he overturned the decision of a jury that he picked. Well, which way do we want that?
Well, Beth is suggesting something more like civilian trial, as I hear, something closer to random, and let the process work through the charges rather than, you know, the commander's assessment of who he or she thinks ought to be on the jury.
Well, you know, she said that the statute requires the convening authority to pick the most qualified people to be members. I don't see how going on a random selection process would get us better qualified members. And I think that this is an old criticism of military mm-hmm. justice, by the way, and I don't think it really has anything to do with the problem of sexual assault and trying to solve it. I've not heard anybody say, well, the reason that this person got acquitted was because the jury was handpicked by a convening authority who wanted them to acquit. There's no question there's an appearance issue with the convening authority picking the court members. However, in my experience, the convening authority picks court members, and they sit for 3 and 4 months at a time. He doesn't pick them for one case just to sit on that case. And in my experience also, convening authorities exercise that quasi-judicial responsibility very carefully and not to handpick a jury to get a conviction or to get an acquittal either way.
And yet,
we're back to the language that Beth quoted from the statute. They're supposed to be the best qualified people by virtue of age, education, experience, training, and judicial temperament.
But clearly, something's out of whack. I mean, everyone's describing this at this point as a crisis in the military. Ryan in Norfolk, Virginia. Ryan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I was just curious with all the statistics and reports that are being quoted on all the various news networks. Nobody really talks about how many of these are end up being either unsubstantiated or found false. And the effects that can have on the career of an officer, an enlisted person in a profession where leadership and presence and personal, integrity is such a large part of what we do. Thank you.
Ryan, are you suggesting, the concern has been that sexual assault has been underreported. Are you saying you think it may be overreported?
No, I still think it's underreported, but there's kind of a frenzy going on in the media now. And I think the way the military addresses and how they handle reporting, it's kind of informed by the fact that they're trying to make sure that, people's lives aren't ruined in the opposite direction.
Yep.
If there's only one military, you can't leave the military and go to another one. So once your reputation is gone, in such a small, some of these officer communities are only 1,000 people.
Yep.
So once your reputation is gone as a leader, you just can't get that back sometimes, and that makes you a victim as well.
Ryan, I appreciate your call. Beth, what do you say to that concern?
This is a risk. We need to protect the civil liberties and the possibility of innocence of persons who are accused. That's absolutely right. I think that from what we know, and we have a lot more empirical data, your caller referenced all the information that's out there. The most recent report from the SAPRO office, the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Officer of the Pentagon, it's been quoted in the news media, but the whole report is 729 pages. There's a tremendous amount of data out there that can't be distilled into short sound bites. But I will say that the importance of protecting people who might be falsely accused is somewhat counterbalanced by the reality that there aren't very many false accusations. So numbers-wise, we're still dealing, from what we know, with a large portion of persons who do not report the crime. We think about 11% of people report this crime against a very small percentage of people who do report falsely.
I mean, we heard at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing this month from Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welch. His remarks got a lot of attention because he seemed to be suggesting that the problem was maybe with the culture outside the military, coming into the military. And I wonder what you two think about it. Here's General Mark Welch, Air Force.
Roughly 20% of the young women who come in to the Department of Defense and the Air Force report that they were sexually assaulted in some way before they came into the military. So they come in from a society where this occurs. Some of it is the hookup mentality of junior high, even, and high school students now, which my children can tell you about, from watching their friends and being frustrated by it. The same demographic group moves into the military. We have got to change the culture once they arrive.
Beth Hillman, is that blame shifting going on there? I wasn't sure how to interpret that.
First, you have to understand any military official who would like to shift the blame on this issue. I mean, the intense white-hot glare of this right now has created lots and lots of pressure. And I think it's correct. This is a society-wide problem. This is not simply a military problem. Just last week, the University of Montana entered into a big consent agreement based on a Title IX suit because of their failure to manage the incident reports of sexual assault and harassment. So it's true. There is a problem society-wide on this, but I don't think the military is helping much with the culture that it creates and fosters once people get there. So I disagree with the general's impression that it's the military has people who are tougher to fix than in the past.
Are you following the debate in Washington now? Do you see legislation coming together that looks like it might actually make these changes around chain of command issues and sexual assault that would move the dial here, Beth?
Maybe General Altenberg would be better equipped to answer that one. I am not inside the Beltway out here in San Francisco, but I am on this DOD panel that's going to look at this, an independent panel. And the Secretary of Defense has been very clear that he wants a top-to-bottom review from that panel and some well-considered recommendations for real change.
General Altenberg, what do you see coming out of, let's say, the Senate? Do you think they're going to push on exactly this point?
Well, I think they will. And I just hope that they let Beth and others who are on that committee have time to work through the issues and study them and look at the facts and the statistics and try to make sense out of them and see, you know, what it all means. I think that the Ryan's call about false allegations is, quite frankly, a lot of men in the military talk about that, and it's misplaced. The statistics on false allegations by women are extremely low. I think part of educating the chain of command is going to be them learning that it is low. And that's part of changing the culture.
A lot of Americans.
Personally, I've been informed on this issue because I had a daughter that served 6 years on active duty and 12 years in the reserve.
That'll get your attention. A lot of American families watching very carefully here. John Altenberg, Elizabeth Hillman, our thanks to both of you for your thoughts this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.